Maybridge. Great to have you with us, and thank you for tuning in, especially if you're not a regular part of our church. We're really glad to have you with us. Today's a significant one. We're starting a new series today. We're a church that takes the Bible seriously. We think it's this amazing thing, somehow authored by both man and God. And we're going to be looking at a particular book of it for a good while. It's called Matthew's Gospel. It's one of the most famous books in the Bible. And it's quite long. It's 28 chapters. So we're going to be looking at it, I reckon, off and on for probably about a year and a half. And for some people, that might sound really mega long, especially in the day of the sort of 5-minute YouTube clip. But by the end of this, we're going to know Jesus really well. We're going to know what he says about all manner of different things. We're going to know everything about his life and his rhythm and everything, with the idea about taking it all on board ourselves. You see, for us, this series is not just about knowing Jesus. It's about being a follower of Jesus. Lots of people claim to follow Jesus, but anyone who's serious about that has to do the hard work of grappling with what he says about all manner of things and living in his ways day to day. And this book is all about that. Now, in the New Testament, there are four books that we call Gospels, four accounts of Jesus' life. They're all telling us about Jesus, but they all have different emphases. And traditionally, Matthew was the first one. If you open the New Testament, it's at the start. And I think that's because it makes the most sense as a sort of bridge from the Old Testament. You see, the Old Testament builds up this story over thousands of years, God working with the people of Israel, and it all points forward to a day when a Messiah figure would come along, a Saviour who would usher in a new kingdom of things being done in God's way, where God's ways would prevail in everything in the world, and it would be amazing, over and above all the other mess that happens. And then the Old Testament ends with the book of Malachi, and then it seems like nothing moves forwards. It seems like God is doing nothing for 400 years. Everyone is either waiting for something to happen, or they gave up. And then in the first century, Jesus shows up, and he does what he does, and loads of people say, it's him, he's the one we were waiting for. And Matthew is a book, more than any other, that is written to declare to Jewish people, the wait is over. The wait is over. It's written by a bloke called Matthew, obviously, also known as Levi, who was a Jewish tax collector. He personally met Jesus. His life was turned upside down. We can see that in Matthew chapter 9. And he follows Jesus closely as a disciple. He sees him die and rise again. It's mind-blowing to him. And so ultimately, he wants to introduce Jesus to his own countrymen, to Jewish people who don't know. The fact that he'd been a tax collector would have given him a particular point of view. He knew about Jewish customs and ideas, and yet he would have been marginalised and disliked by his own people because he was a tax collector. They weren't very popular. So he's probably taken a lot of flack in life, but what's happened to him has changed him so much. He's now desperate to introduce Jewish people to Jesus. It's like this whole book is one of those big pointy foam hands pointing over Jesus and saying, look, everyone, it's him. It's him. The wait is over. It's brilliant. It's him. But he doesn't just tell us who Jesus is. He's very heavy on what it looks like to follow him in everyday life. He wants every reader to be an apprentice, a disciple of Jesus. And one great thing about this book is that because it's trying to connect with Jewish people, it retells stories from the Old Testament over and over, but with Jesus as the true and better version of whoever was the hero in that Old Testament story. So we're going to bump into loads of that. It's really rich. It'll be really interesting to grapple with. So this great book, at the beginning of the New Testament, the most influential library of texts ever written, how does it start? It must be epic, right? To begin the New Testament, it's got to be epic. Let's have a think about how the other three Gospels start first. You know, you've got Mark, shortest Gospel, everything's 100 miles an hour, there's no detail, there's no reflection, it's like an excited child telling you all about Jesus, he's the Son of God, he did this, he did that, bang, bang, story, story. Luke is completely different. He's a doctor and historian. He writes to his Roman benefactor and says, I've undertaken to write you an orderly account. He's all very serious, historical detail. He knows that it's important and he gets it spot on. John is totally different again. His first line is, in the beginning. He echoes the first line of Genesis. It's this big theological, philosophical reflection. Jesus is the cosmic God, but he's also down here somehow. And he marries Jewish thinking with the terminology of Greek philosophy and it's absolute genius. Any of these Gospels would have been a worthy opening, and yet none was traditionally placed at the start of the New Testament. What's the grand opening? If you or I had seen Jesus and we wrote a book about him, how would we begin? Maybe we'd get a line of his best teaching in there, or something super wise that he said, or maybe if we'd seen some amazing miracle that Jesus is said to have done, we'd go with that. something to grab the attention and demand further interest. That's not how the Gospel of Matthew begins. He does the absolute last thing any of us would do in writing a book about Jesus. He starts with a super long and seemingly very dull list of names. And today we're going to look at this list of names and find that actually, quietly, it's an amazing and appropriate way to introduce Jesus to the world. Now, to be fair, it does start off with a bit of an explosive line. Remember, Matthew is addressing Jewish people, and he starts like this, 1 verse 1. This is a record of the ancestors of Jesus the Messiah, a descendant of David and of Abraham. Seems simple enough, but what he's doing straight out is saying, those thousands of years of Old Testament, that 400 years of silence, it's all done. This guy's the Messiah. He's the person our culture has been waiting for. Our hopes, our dreams, our search for a resolution to our problems, it's done. It's this guy. Now, if you're a first century Jew or a Jew from any time, and somebody says, this guy's the Messiah, you're immediately going to drop your falafel and say, okay, I'm listening. What? Who is this? What's he about? Why should I believe any of this? And in the same sentence, Matthew starts answering in a very Jewish way. He says Jesus is a descendant of David and Abraham. For a Jewish person, these are two heavyweights. Abraham was the father of all Jewish people. It wasn't particularly special to be descended from him because everybody was. But the key thing with Abraham is that in the Old Testament story, right at the start of the Bible, God said to him, through your descendant, I will bless the whole world. In other words, name-checking Abraham makes the story both very Jewish and very inclusive to everybody else. David, on the other hand, was Israel's greatest king. Fewer people descended from him, but he wasn't exactly monogamous, if you read his story. And a fair few people could trace their lineage back to him. So the reason that Matthew name checks these two men, firstly, because according to the Old Testament predictions, the Messiah would have to be descended from them. And secondly, as we'll see in a minute, Matthew is saying there is a symbolic generational gap between the three men. But we'll get to that. So that's the opening line. Big claim, big implications. Now we're going to read forward through what is basically a list of names. But we're going to pause each time we get to something significant because none of this is written by accident. This is all very, very deliberate. So it says, Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. So for the Jewish people, this starts in a very familiar way. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Everyone knew about them. But as soon as they get mentioned, everyone's thinking about all the stories they grew up with, all the adventures for their people for thousands of years, all the family fallouts. But they're also thinking about God. God was, and still is, amongst Jewish people, called the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. And that was intended to be reassuring. It reminds them, this is the God who is the one who remains from generation to generation, one decade, one era to the next, and he always has a plan. And at the time that Matthew wrote this, it's been 400 years of bleakness. Where's the plan? And Matthew says, hey, hold on, remember, it's the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. It's him. He's still there. And let me show you, he's got something up his sleeve. And then Matthew tells us that Judah, that was both a person and a tribe, one of the 12 tribes Israel had, Judah was father to Perez and Zerah, and for the first time, Matthew names a woman, Tamar. Now, you may or may not know her story, but in the Old Testament book of Genesis, Tamar was actually the daughter-in-law of this man, Judah. And it's a long story, but he thinks that she's a prostitute, and eventually he sleeps with her, and they have a baby. So Judah was the father of a whole tribe, significant historical figure, but really he wasn't a nice guy. In fact, I think he was fairly despicable. He tries to get Tamar burned to death after she has the baby. So we're two verses into the start of the New Testament, and we're being reminded of one of the worst stories imaginable. Why? Where is this going? Well, key thing here, Matthew does not cover up the fact that Jesus was descended from a sex offender. Doesn't cover it up. Let's continue. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Aminadab. Aminadab was the father of Nashon. Nashon was the father of Salmon. And Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. So here we bump into another woman who was key in the Old Testament story. Back in the book of Joshua, the Hebrew people, led by Joshua, are entering the land that would become Israel later on. And this lady called Rahab, who already lived there, was a prostitute who lived in the city where they were going to enter into the country. And she ends up helping the men who came from the people of Israel, or will become the people of Israel, the people who come and spy on the land. She ends up helping them. So Rahab isn't a villain, but it would have been surprising to anybody reading this that Matthew is saying the Messiah's great-great-great-great-grandma, however many generations back, was not Jewish. And not only that, she was a sex worker. The Messiah, Matthew is saying, was descended from a non-Jewish sex worker. So Matthew doesn't cover up the fact Jesus was descended from a Gentile prostitute, which from a Jewish point of view was not a good thing at all. Matthew doesn't cover it up. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed was the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother was Bathsheba, the widow of Uriah. And here we get to David, that revered king. Lots of people would want to be associated with him. He was the glorious leader. He beat Goliath. He inspired the people. He wrote loads of great worship songs. But the only thing that Matthew reminds us about in the varied and exciting life of David is that his son Solomon was the product of an affair. In the Old Testament story, David organised for Bathsheba's husband to be killed, and then he slept with her. And she probably didn't have a great deal of choice. She was seduced by the king. I mean, how low can you get? Matthew doesn't cover up the fact that Jesus was descended from a murderer and an adulterer. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam was the father of Abijah. Abijah was the father of Asa. Asa was the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was the father of Jehoram. Jehoram was the father of Uzziah. Uzziah was the father of Jotham. Jotham was the father of Ahaz. Ahaz was the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh. Manasseh was the father of Amon. Amon was the father of Josiah. Josiah was the father of Jehoiakim and his brothers, born at the same time of the exile to Babylon. Through this list of simple names, at this point, Matthew reminds everybody of Israel's history. These people in this bit of the list, these were all kings of Israel. And some of them were decent kings, they were all right. And some of them were absolutely awful, just complete disasters. And it's a real mixed bag. This was what Matthew's telling us. And it reminds us that this is just what happens. Things are up and down. And even if you take the long-term view, good king, bad king, it doesn't go very well. The overall trajectory is that things just sort of get worse for the people. And it's not just Israel's story, it's a picture of the story of humanity. All our nations are mixed bags. All of us individually, capable of good, capable of bad. Where does it end? How does it continue? For Israel, the people ended up in exile. Literally, the nation was invaded and loads of people, thousands of people, were carted off to Babylon. And it was terrible. And God had warned them for years and years, if you don't stop this, if you don't stop pushing me away, and don't stop doing loads of terrible things, this is eventually going to happen. And they didn't listen, and then finally, of course, it did. Matthew does not cover up the fact that Jesus was descended from high-profile, powerful, high-power people who were personally responsible for rejecting God and therefore had to face the consequences. After the Babylonian exile, Jehoiakim was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel was the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was the father of Abiud. Abiud was the father of Eliakim. Eliakim was the father of Azor. Azor was the father of Zadok. Zadok was the father of Akim. Akim was the father of Eliud. Eliud was the father of Eleazar. Eleazar was the father of Matan. Matan was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. By the way, if you're looking out for a baby name anytime soon, great text. But this tells us the exile doesn't last forever. The Jews slowly start to come home. More generations pass. And then here we get to Mary and Joseph, who we all remember from every Christmas when you see the nativity and everything's going on around Christmas. Mum and dad to baby Jesus. But it's worth noting, it doesn't say that Joseph was the father of Jesus, just that he was Mary's husband. And that's because, as Matthew will go on to say, Jesus' conception and birth are this once-in-history miracle. Joseph is not his biological dad. We'll get onto more of that next week. But here's the thing for now. Neither Mary or Joseph was from an impressive family. They didn't have money or power or education. They weren't royalty like some of their ancestors. They were just simple peasant teenagers engaged to be married when Mary becomes pregnant with Jesus. Matthew does not cover up the fact that Jesus was descended from poor, unimpressive people who were basically nobodies as far as the world was concerned. And then he simply writes this: Mary gave birth to Jesus, who is called the Messiah. All those names, all those messed up, complicated, sometimes downright terrible people, and then Jesus bookends it. And Matthew's back to that word Messiah, which literally means anointed, not a word that we use very much, anointed, but it means set apart, somebody special. And then Matthew has one more line in this passage, because there's just one more thing he wants to say about all of this. All those listed above include 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the Babylonian exile, and 14 from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah. So he's basically saying from Abraham all the way to Jesus is three sets of 14. Now, I'm usually very skeptical when people try to find numerical patterns in the Bible. Most of them are a load of rubbish. But here the author himself is blatantly showing us something with these numerical patterns. He says so himself. What's he doing? Well, of course, there'd be a nice symmetry in having 14 generations between these key moments in Jewish history. Although actually, Matthew misses out loads of people in this list. The people he could have easily found by just copying them out from the Old Testament, but he doesn't. That's not what he's trying to do. He's not trying to give us a comprehensive history. What he's doing is painting a symbolic picture that involves the number 14. And here's why. In Jewish thinking, the number 7 was symbolic of perfection. It was symbolic of God, associated with God. Double 7, i.e. 14, would symbolise absolute and complete perfection. Perfection that can't be changed. But why three sets of 14? Well, if Abraham was the father of a nation, and David was the greatest king, and the exile was the symbol historically of God's judgment, in the Jewish mind, Matthew is saying Jesus is somehow the summary of father, king, and judge in our world. And who is father, king, and judge? God. And so Matthew is saying this incredible thing. He's saying not only is Jesus the Jewish Messiah, which is pretty massive itself, he's saying he's also all the things that God is. In other words, he is God. So in a very Jewish way, Matthew is launching us into understanding who Jesus is. And it's really clever because he marries together all this lofty stuff about the Messiah and God, and it's all incredible, with very normal, down-to-earth stuff about the lives of ordinary people throughout history. It's amazing. But there's also another dimension to this too that we could easily miss. And it's helpful just to know some of the history around this. If you or I apply for a job, what's the first thing that we do? Probably we put in our CV, we have a bit of paper that explains our credentials, and we try and, in our CV, give the best version of ourselves in the hope that we might get the job. And sometimes, of course, on the CV, people will stretch the truth a little bit, but basically, you're trying to make yourself as good as you possibly can within the facts. It's your introduction to who you are and what it is you have to bring. In ancient Israel, your family was your CV. It was your CV. It was your way in. If you came from a good family, maybe a family with a good reputation or great wealth, it would help you to be accepted. It, just like a strong CV does now when you apply for a job, it helps you get in. And the thing is, in first century Jewish thinking, Jesus did not have a great CV. And Matthew doesn't hide that. In fact, if anything, he emphasizes it. He doesn't edit Jesus' family background to make him look artificially great somehow. He doesn't mention all the good things just to make Jesus sound like he's from the best stock. This would be like me writing a CV for myself now and saying, I'm unreliable, I'm lazy, and I quite like stealing things. Please, can you give me a job? It would just be absolute employment suicide. This is surely not how you make a case for how great Jesus is. This is not surely how you introduce the Jewish Messiah, God come to earth. Why on earth would Matthew do this? Beyond just being honest about the people he mentions, I think Matthew wants to use this genealogy to show us three different things. Firstly, Jesus comes to messy people. This text is not an attempt to justify a religious regime or a moral order or anything like that. Matthew is a Jewish man writing to Jewish people, and he's incredibly critical, realistically critical, of Jewish history. He's not saying, hey everybody, look, our Jewish religion is brilliant, everybody needs to be more like us and take our Jewish ways on and it'll make everything better. Most cultures tend to see themselves as better than other cultures, that's human nature. But this doesn't read that way. He looks back and says to his fellow Jews, our history is checkered at best. It's got peaks and troughs. It's up and down. Even when we had some amazing kings and leaders, we still ended up in exile because we still messed up. But this is not just a story of what Israel's like. It's what everywhere is like, of course. Every culture, including ours, has family stories that read like the plot of EastEnders, fallouts, sex scandals, horrendous evil that you just hope nobody finds out about. The story of Israel is the story of the world. And Matthew says it needs to stop. It needs sorting out. It needs rescuing. This is what humanity is always like. And it needs a resolution. That's what Jesus enters into. That's the point. He's not just come out of nowhere saying, hey, I'm God. This is the crucial, epic climax of the story. Secondly, it goes further. Jesus identifies with messy people. Matthew's telling us Jesus is this Messiah, he's this long-awaited superstar saviour figure, and even more than that, he pictures him as God come to earth. But in doing so, he doesn't separate Jesus away from humanity. That history of names is Matthew saying, yeah, there's all this mess, but Jesus identifies with them. He places himself alongside these people. He's God of the universe, but he's also Mary and Joseph's boy from Nazareth. This is designed to both shock and reassure us at the same time. God comes down to us, to our level, like in a film where the superpowered hero comes down to help the normal people. He's from up there, but he gets stuck in down here. And yet he's not this sort of external figure. He becomes part of humanity. He makes himself one of us. And thirdly, Jesus is the solution for messy people. He doesn't just show up and get in the trenches with us. He shows up to win the war. We need a God who knows what we're like, gets alongside us anyway, and bookends the problem, who ends the mess, who is the solution to the human condition. Over the next 28 chapters that we're going to look at this book, and for however long we're going to be doing that as a church, we will see just how richly and deeply Jesus and the kingdom that he leads are exactly what our world needs on every single level. Going to be brilliant. For today, a couple of thoughts for us. We're not a bunch of first century Jews, obviously. We're a church in West Sussex in the 21st century, but this is a story that's supposed to invite everybody in. So two things. Firstly, consider how your family has shaped you. None of us can help the environment that we grew up in. Some of us had great families, some of us didn't. Even the great ones weren't perfect. But everybody, every one of us was shaped by the people who raised us. Our values, our priorities and so on were shaped by the people that raised us. I remember when I was a teenager and my dad was a vicar and sometimes people rang the house to speak to him. And if I answered the phone, my voice was so similar, they thought I was him. And at the time, as a teenager, I found that really, really annoying. With hindsight, I could have just used it to get them to tell me all of their big secrets, but I didn't think of that then. But things pass down through our families, don't they, in the place where we're raised. And one of the things we see in the Bible is how things get passed on and on through generations as time goes on. And we see it today. We often take on things that our parents do, don't we? Whether that's a perfectly good thing like following a career path or their love of cooking, or a not so good thing like following their anxiety or their dependence on alcohol or their cynicism. Happens to everybody. And there may be things about yourself that you know have descended down through your family, and you think, I just don't want to be like that. I don't want it for me. I don't want to pass it on to my own kids. I don't want to be the things that I received. And humanly, it's really hard. You're trying, but you just can't help but being the things that you don't want to be. But Jesus is the bookend on problems that pass down through generations, through sin, through darkness that passes down, evil through passes down through generations. He bookends it. He changes people that cannot change themselves because he comes in the trenches with us and is like us. Today's passage tells us the score. It's not just what happened, it's what always happens. People make a mess and the repercussions echo through the generations, and there's no way out of the cycle unless Jesus steps in. So why not be honest with him? It might help to talk to someone else, and there are people at our church available for that. Just get in touch. But speak to God. You may have never done that before. You may have never done it over this topic. But talk to God about your family, the things that have transferred through, the things you're ashamed of and upset by, and where you want this to be a point where a line is drawn. It might not be something that will change overnight, but facing it and inviting God into it can be the start. Secondly, and most importantly, know that Jesus identifies with you. We've said that Jesus identified with his family and with his people. He also identifies with you personally. You've definitely done and thought things that you don't want people to know. You may even have done things as bad as some of the people in the passage that we read today. You might, even if you identify as a follower of Jesus, you might have that underlying fear that you can't really associate with God. Not really. You're too dirty, too damaged, too messed up. You've gone too far. But look at the people Jesus has already associated with. Prostitutes, murderers, rapists, people who led an entire country into depravity. He won't walk away from you. He's happy to identify with you as well. And it might not even be about anything that you've done. You might have had things done to you. You might be the product of a relationship that should never have happened. On a human level, you might feel like you're here by accident. You might feel illegitimate or unworthy or outside things. But no, Jesus willingly identifies with people like you. Don't be too proud and push him away. Today might be a good day to embrace or embrace for the first time that he gladly wishes to identify with you and your family. Maybe the real question is, are you ready to identify with him? Will you throw your lot in with him? So as we start this book, Matthew's Gospel, I hope that this is somewhat whet your appetite. Even a seemingly uninspiring list of names tells us something of the story of Jesus, of what God is up to, and how it's uniquely relevant to every single one of us right now too. And I want to invite you to join me in learning from and wrestling with this text as deeply as we possibly can for the months ahead. Why not, as we do this each week, read the passage, think about it for yourself. As you look at it in maybe a partnership group, a group in midweek, grapple with it ahead, read it ahead, think about the questions that you have, and let's be apprentices, disciples of this man Jesus, who is more than just a man. He's alongside us, he's a human with us, but he's also God come to earth. It's a wonderful thing. You never know, looking at this book might just change your life. That's what it's there for. Let me pray. Father God, thank you for this wonderful book you've given us. I pray you'd inspire us to wrestle with it and enjoy it as a church, that we would let it speak to us and change us. Thank you for what we've looked at today, that your son came to be with us, to identify with us, despite what we're like. And the things that have a hold over us, things that maybe have been passed through our families for centuries even, do not need to have the final say in our lives, because you do. We're sorry for where we chose to perpetuate problems that have gone on for years. Help us to escape. Thank you that on the cross, Jesus took every piece of that from every family onto himself and dealt with it. Let us live in light of what he did, not what we do. Amen.